Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and is provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargin. Join host Chris Kington Barker today as she speaks with SLO County public health officials as they provide an update on SLO County's COVID-19 response, including how the COVID-19 vaccine task force is facilitating vaccine delivery. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today between 1 and 2 o'clock. Call in and be part of the discussion at 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. I'll give it over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Rachel. The COVID-19 pandemic has killed over 400,000 people in the U.S., and while hope is on the rise, with two vaccines currently being distributed in the U.S., virus is considered to be widespread on the Central Coast, with hundreds of new infections reported daily. Today's show will address questions about what you should do if you come down with the virus and dispel some misinformation about pandemic treatments. We'll also receive updates about SLO County's COVID response efforts and how the vaccine task force is facilitating vaccine delivery and plans to cover SLO County residents going forward. My first guest is a public health expert and emergency room physician, Dr. Clint Slaughter, who's been dealing with pandemic's rise and has firsthand impact. The second half of today's show will all be joined by Ann McDowell, SLO County Public Health Epidemiologist, and Michelle Shoresman, SLO County Health Agency Division Manager and Public Health Information Officer for the COVID-19 response with SLO County Public Health. And welcome, Dr. Slaughter. It's good to see you.
Hi, thank you very much for having me, Chris.
So you've really been in the thick of things with the different emergency rooms that you've been working. Can you talk a little bit about what it has been like for you over the last year since this rise of this pandemic?
Absolutely. It's been definitely a big change in how we practice medicine on the front lines. It's been a lot of different considerations, a lot of adapting. I come into work many days and just ask, what's new today? What has changed about our protocols, or what are we doing differently? And how are we testing? Because it does seem to change very rapidly. And part of that's because the information is changing rapidly. I work at French Hospital Medical Center as well as Rio Grande Community Hospital. I've been at both of those hospitals for 17 years now. And also up at King City at Mead Memorial Hospital a couple of days a month. And that's been for the past year or so. And we've had a lot of COVID. We have had to adapt all the time. And it's been, it's different. We never really had to deal with disease processes that put our lives at risk on a daily basis. Getting a vaccine has been huge, and it really helps psychologically as well as for the safety of all our frontline workers. And hopefully we'll be seeing a drop in numbers as more people get vaccinated. So it's certainly been interesting, and it's been a bit of a roller coaster.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the protocols keep changing, which means the way that you're handling things, what you have to do inside, how you have to protect yourselves and other patients. In the patient population that you're dealing with, we had low numbers initially, at least in San Luis County, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now those are just really increasing.
So, right. Yeah, I mean, we successfully flattened the curve with the first shutdown. That was kind of the big talk from the beginning, is we need to not overwhelm local emergency departments. And we did that really, really well. And the problem is, the next question was, well, when do we reopen? When is the risk low enough that we can start having more contact with people? And unfortunately, we've discovered that the answer is really not until we have herd immunity and we have a vaccine, which is a vaccine plus a lot of people getting infected, unfortunately, and us keeping the numbers down as well. So it definitely has changed, because we were hoping we could just flatten the curve and then it would go away and summer would come and it would, like a lot of different viruses such as influenza, really essentially go away for the most part over the summertime. COVID-19 does not do that. It continues throughout the year with some variability, but it hasn't really followed. We've been figuring it out as it has presented itself to us. So we've had to keep changing our assumptions.
Yeah, and with this kind of a virus, the idea of masking, that's been such an issue for so many people. Do you find that taking safety precautions is something that's a necessary thing? And do
Oh,
you
absolutely. I mean, everybody should be wearing a mask in public. We should not be having any groups getting together indoors, especially without masks on. I mean, that is very clear in the data. I mean, anybody that's still opposing mask use is just not informed, or they just don't understand the data. And interestingly, I see a lot of pushback. And people will say, well, what about Fauci? He said no masks at the beginning. But that was interesting. It was a lack of transparency, which we're seeing a lot, unfortunately. You'd think that government agencies and everybody would realize by now that you just have to be as open as possible on every possible thing, so people understand what your motivations are and why certain things are happening. And initially, what they should have said is, hey, masks will help, but we need these masks for the frontline hospital workers.
Right.
So you can't go buy all these surgical masks. You should start making masks. We could have had, actually, I'm one of the co-founders of the makerspace here locally. We made thousands of masks and gave them out to people through the beginning, especially this pandemic and over the summer. So that was pretty amazing. But basically, the message should have been from the beginning. Yes, everybody should wear masks. Yes, it absolutely helps to decrease transmission, especially from somebody that has COVID-19. And you still get decreased transmission if you are wearing a mask and you're exposed to someone with COVID-19. So on both ends, it definitely helps, but it helps more as the mask wearer if you are an asymptomatic carrier or you have COVID-19. It absolutely markedly decreases the risk of transmission. I mean, it goes down to about 95, almost 100% if you're wearing an N95 mask. If you are wearing a regular kind of medical mask or one of those disposable masks, it goes down by anywhere from 30 to 80%, depending on the studies. And then you wear it, second, two masks is the big thing right now. And sure, that's going to help too. Everything we do will decrease transmission. And I think a lot of people are coming at it from the point of view that, well, if it doesn't prevent transmission, why am I doing it? But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about decreasing transmission, and every little thing we do helps. So if you wear a mask, it helps. If you wear two masks, it helps a little more. If everybody's wearing a mask, it helps more. If you're keeping socially distant, more than 6 feet outdoors, that helps even more. If you're not having gatherings inside, that helps. So everything we do is helpful, and it shouldn't be discounted at all. So yes, masking is absolutely imperative.
When you've seen people coming into the emergency room, have you seen evidence that, gathering and those kinds of things have really been a transmission point for a lot of these individuals?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's almost comical sometimes, but it's also depressing for us when yet another person comes in, like, yeah, I guess I shouldn't have gone to that Christmas party because now I've got COVID. And that happens all the time. I just saw a patient yesterday that went and visited family somewhere recently, and they came back with COVID. We're telling people over and over again, don't have gatherings. And this big spike, we were already on the upswing, and all this stuff is logarithmic as far as it's a numbers game. And the more cases that are in a community, the more chance of getting it. So then the more risks you take, the more chance you have. I mean, if you're engaging in risky behavior in an area that has really low viral cases, then you're not going to see as much transmission and it's not as risky. But if we have huge numbers like we do right now, and you're in an area where it's more endemic, then anything you do, there's a good chance that you're going to get COVID in a gathering. We had a nurse that went back to visit his family because of a tragedy, and ended up, he and his wife wore masks. Everybody else didn't. And they were the only ones that didn't get COVID. So it's, it,
Wow.
yeah. So, I mean, the message should be, and it has been, but people aren't listening a lot, is don't have gatherings with other people. I mean, you can have a very small pod of people that are also very close knit and aren't having many exposures that you can kind of have more exposure with to some extent. But even that, I mean, our family's been pretty strict about it, as you can imagine. We have some friends that we see, for play dates with the kids, but it's still outdoors. The kids are wearing masks. Nobody really comes in the house. Except for to go to the bathroom, and that's wearing a mask and washing hands. So it's been pretty tight. But I mean, we've made it a year without having COVID in our house, knock on wood. But
Yeah.
it's working.
Yeah. What about, there are also the gator masks, which are kind of like the passive aggressive masks that kind of is a mask.
I gotta tell you, I like the gator masks to some extent. I don't think they're as passive aggressive as they have become to be. And it turned the study that showed that those aren't quite as effective was it was actually a test of technology. So it was basically they were doing a study on if you could pick up and quantify the number of particles getting through a mask using a smartphone camera. I mean, it was a really tiny little test, and it was a one kind of shot deal. And it did show that some of those kind of masks are less protective than other masks. And then there was a theory because it might have aerosolized it a little more that it could increase transmission, but that didn't really bear out. So those are still okay, but not as good as a regular mask. And if you're going to wear those, you should kind of fold it over and double the layer of fabric. And then there are other ones that have a little pocket that you could put in it for an extra extra filter.
So it needs to be a little bit better in terms of how it's worn, not pulled all the way down.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday and they had the gear
mask under the nose.
It was below the nose. I'm like, come on, guys, you gotta get it up over the nose.
Yeah. What has been the impact with all these patients coming in? I mean, we're seeing that the admission rates and the hospitalization rates are higher in San Luis County than they have been. Mm-hmm. If you've got as many people in the ICU as is being reported, that would seem to reflect that there are a lot of patients that can't be in the ICU that may have been used in the ICU before, or maybe it wasn't being used. Are there elective surgeries now, or are there elective patients that are encouraged not to have those surgeries or not to have those procedures because
I think
of
it's
this?
We're doing elective surgeries again. That had shut down initially. That is back now. And it is a little slower than it was before because there's more screening and more difficult to schedule to some extent, but it's still happening. And as far as ICU has been a really interesting thing because I think we had overestimated numbers that were recently corrected because public health came to the hospitals and it was great. It was a great exercise saying, hey, how many ICU beds could you guys have if you had the surge? And so the hospitals were getting creative. It's like we could use the pediatric ICU as an adult ICU. We can use our old part of our old ER as a makeshift ICU. We can rearrange these things. So they gave them these kind of falsely inflated numbers, which looked good for a long time because they weren't full because they weren't real beds. And then we've come into other issues where, you know, Arroyo Grande Hospital is, we have a small ICU that we don't have any intensivists to staff it. So all of the COVID patients are going down to Marion and out of county. So it took a while for, I think, the numbers to catch up on those facts and how we're actually using the ICUs. And then on top of that is even if we have an 8 or 10 or 12 bed ICU, some days there's only nurses to staff 8 of those beds. And so we have 4 beds empty but it's full because we don't have the staffing. So that's been a big issue. And I would say from an ICU standpoint, the ICU is usually pretty full, and it always is outside of COVID too. It's oftentimes pretty full. And what happens is, you know, we'll have a full ICU with 10 patients in there, and then 2 patients will die, so there'll be 2 more spots. So when the beds open up, unfortunately, it's not because people, I mean, sometimes people are getting better, of course, but sometimes people are dying. So it's kind of, you know, it's not good to have those open beds when it's because somebody's passed away, unfortunately. But it seems like it's just it's always going up and down. So one day I'll go to work and we are holding 2 patients because we don't have regular hospital beds and the ICU is full. And the next day we aren't holding anybody. Everybody's found a bed and we've got 1 or 2 beds open in the ICU. So it's constantly changing depending on the day.
If you're holding patients in the ERs or you're holding them someplace other than an ICU bed where they can truly be separated, are you able to maintain the integrity of protection for other patients from exposure to COVID?
We are. And it's fortunate that we ended up with a brand new ER at French and Arroyo Grande. So mm-hmm. both places have brand new ERs and most of the rooms are, we have closable doors. We can keep people in isolation. We've got plenty of PPE. So we are doing a lot to keep all patients safe, both patients with COVID. We want to keep them away from other people, of course. And then the patients who don't have COVID who need to come to the ER. One of the big messages I have for everybody is if you are sick, if you have something going on that you don't know what's happening, chest pain, anything, abdominal pain. I actually had a patient die because they waited too long to come to the ER and they made it. We found out they had a major abdominal problem that needed to go to the operating room. And they basically didn't make it to the operating room because they had waited for 3 days because they were worried about getting COVID. And it's horrible. It's a horrible tragedy when these kind of things happen because they're preventable. So we want people to come into the ER if you're sick. You will be protected. We have isolation protocols. We keep everybody as safe as possible. The chance of you getting COVID in the hospital or in the ER is very, very, very low. So that's a big message I have for everybody. Please seek out medical care when you need it.
And talk a little bit about when patients who think they may have symptoms of COVID should come to the ER and maybe when they should call their doctor. Can you kind of differentiate?
That's a great question. So when you, if you've been exposed to somebody with COVID-19, you know, there's protocols that you can look up on the CDC, but essentially there's the exposure protocols and then there's symptomatic protocols as well. So if you are symptomatic and you think you may have COVID-19 or you know somebody with COVID-19, you don't need to come to the ER just because you think you have it. I mean, we can test you if you're symptomatic. It's a really big bill, unfortunately. I mean, coming to the ER is, you know, probably $600 or $800 just to come to the ER. I'm not sure what the, you know, I don't do any of the billing. I just get to take care of patients, which I love. But things are expensive. It's the most expensive place to seek out healthcare. And so there are free places to get testing. You know, go to readyslow.org, and I'm sure Michelle's going to talk about this later. And you can, there's free set tests that you can get. You can also go to, there's MedStop. There's the Dignity Health clinics have testing. You need to call ahead, but there's a lot of places in the county you can get outpatient testing. And so that's it takes a couple of days to get it back. We can sometimes do it faster in the ER, but it's the most expensive place to get the test. So the reason you would come to the ER, though, is if you're – so common symptoms, fever, sore throat, cough, congestion, headaches, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, shortness of breath. Those are kind of the typical symptoms we get. Initially, it was amazing. We didn't realize all of a sudden people are coming with vomiting and diarrhea and no other symptoms. And we realized in the first couple of months, hey, this is COVID too. This is unusual. We usually don't get all of these different symptoms with one virus. So so if you have those kind of symptoms, you very well may have COVID. So you should get tested. You should immediately quarantine yourself to avoid spreading it to anybody else and wait for your testing to come back. If you're vomiting and have diarrhea and you can't keep fluids down and you're getting dehydrated, yes, come to the ER. Absolutely. We can hydrate you. We can give you nausea medication. If you feel more and more short of breath, we're actually telling people to get home pulse oximeters that go on your finger. They're about $30 or so on Amazon or in local pharmacies, and you can keep an eye on your pulse oxygenation. And so if you drop below 90%, you should come to the ER. If you're below 90 and stay below 90 and you're feeling symptoms come in, you'll probably need oxygen therapy. You may need to be admitted for oxygen therapy. If you're in the low 90s, it's funny. I tell patients all the time, you know, we have all of this data and all of these, you know, treatments that we've been trying, and really none of the treatments work very well at all, if at all. And so there's really nothing to do to make you better faster. But the best thing we've had is flipping people over like a pancake. So the prone positioning actually does help to recruit other alveoli in your lungs and will improve your oxygenation even if you're at home. So I'm telling people that if their oxygenation is in the low 90s, you can just kind of flip over for a while you're watching TV and try to recruit some more alveoli. And then if you stay below 90, come into the ER. Absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. I'm Chris Kington-Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. As of yesterday, there were 17,366 reported cases of COVID-19 in Slo County, with 1,850 of them still active and 49 residents being treated in the hospital. Of the 585 individuals who've been hospitalized, 47% of those people have been under the age of 65, while 88% of the reported deaths have occurred in individuals 65 and older. Dr. Clint Slaughter is an emergency room physician and a public health professional who's been practicing on the Central Coast for the last 17 years. He's gotten all too familiar with COVID-19 and its impact on patients of all ages in the past year, and is here to share some useful information. If you have a question for Dr. Slaughter, you can call it in to us at 805-549-8855 or email us at voices@kcbx.org. Dr. Slaughter, there have been all kinds of Dr. Google kinds of things about COVID and what works to prevent it and offset some of the issues with it. And, you know, are there any things that you've heard about that can help with some of the symptoms, that can relieve some of the time frames in terms of healing or getting better, that make any sense, or is it all just kind of ballyhoo?
Yeah, well, it's a lot of optimistic hopefulness, I think. And nothing, unfortunately, really works all that well that we've found so far. So that's unfortunate. I mean, there's all these, every once in a while, it seems like a new drug comes up. We've had, hydroxychloroquine, we've had melatonin, ivermectin, colchicine, all these things, have come out as possible treatments, and frankly, none of them work very well, if at all. And that's the problem. And they've been studied at very small studies. Rarely are they randomized prospective trials, although those are kind of coming slowly to really see if we have any kind of real statistically significant effect from these drugs without a significant side effect. So colchicine is one of the newer ones. It's interesting. I was just looking up some. So they did a couple of studies in December, and it was only 70 or 150 patients in these two studies. And it showed maybe up to 20% reduction in mortality. And that was in the hospital. But colchicine is a really toxic drug that we give it to patients with gout. And the old instructions on how to give this medication were take one pill an hour until you get diarrhea. And because you will get diarrhea after, I'm sorry to keep saying the word, but after a couple of doses, and it's miserable. So, I mean, this causes kidney failure. This causes dehydration. It's a dangerous drug with a very narrow therapeutic window. And the doses they're using are rather high. So it's, I think, 0.5 milligrams twice a day for 4 or 5 days. So it's not a great medication. And that's only been studied then in that subsection of patients that are already really sick in the hospital. Yeah. So that's part of the problem. Some of these medications seem to have maybe a tiny bit of help in a very specific subsection of patient if you catch it in the right time. But then if you're out of that window, it doesn't really do anything. And then you're increasing your risk from side effects.
There was this little study that was done, I think, on the variant that they're seeing in Brazil now that had to do with vitamin D.
Vitamin D may help a bit. You know, that's definitely not going to hurt you. That's the thing. Some things, you know, you can try that. Melatonin might help a little bit, you know, but nothing is really going to be a savior. Nothing is really going to make it go away or make you get better very, very much more quickly. So it's really just ibuprofen, Tylenol, nausea medication, rest, fluids, and just hanging in there until it gets better for the most part. I mean, we're still looking for better medications, but nothing has really shown. And for example, bamlanivimab, which I have to always practice saying bamlanivimab, one of the antibodies, they just reviewed all the data. It turns out when they initially did the study that showed that there was some efficacy in patients early on, that it really is not very efficacious. And just because they, I think the headline was there was statistical chicanery. So I'm just wonderful to use the word chicanery in discussing how we're figuring out if these medications work or not. So it's disappointing. I mean, we have something that we thought was going to work. We're starting to give it to patients. It's super expensive and has a narrow window, but now it turns out it really doesn't do much at all. So
on average, how long are patients ending up staying in the hospital once they get there if they need to be hospitalized?
You know, I am not entirely sure, but it depends on how sick you are. I've seen some patients be in for just a few days, and if they're stable, sometimes they'll go home and possibly go home on oxygen, and they can stay at home in quarantine if they're doing well. Otherwise, other patients are in the hospital for weeks or months. And if you are unfortunate to be sick enough to be intubated, we're seeing patients that are intubated for weeks and getting tracheotomies, and many of them are not recovering. So it's once you're that bad, it's pretty severe illness, and it's not a good prognosis.
If someone has to be intubated as a result of COVID, are there some other issues that can develop as a process of the intubation?
Well, I mean, being intubated is very difficult for your entire body. You have to be sedated, so you're essentially unconscious, and it's hard to sedate some people, so it can be very uncomfortable at times. You know, the nurses and doctors do their best to monitor, but sometimes people start waking up, and then it's, of course, panic-inducing to be, have a tube down your trachea and having a machine pushing air into your lungs. So it's terrifying, and it's not good for your system. Interestingly, when people are intubated with COVID, we have to use much higher pressures because we're trying to open those alveoli that are full of fluid and inflammatory material. And so you can pop blebs in your lungs. You can have pneumothoraces. That's traumatic to have that much pressure in your lungs. So for example, there's something called PEEP, which stands for positive end expiratory pressure, which is, if you imagine a ventilator pushing air into your lungs, the PEEP is basically the leftover pressure at the end. So usually it's around 5 is the PEEP. And so you still push the 5 millimeters of mercury of pressure into your lungs. And then you start your next breath, where now we're running PEEP up to 10, 12, 14, which is really high and really, keeps those lungs inflated. So it causes what's called barotrauma over time. So you pop alveoli and it can have scarring of the lungs. So it's difficult to be intubated.
And that's a long lasting.
It can be. Well, that's then there's a whole other issue of the long haulers with COVID. So even young people that are getting sick we're seeing up to maybe 20% of people are getting these long haul symptoms with continued shortness of breath or muscle aches or fatigue. And so that's the other terrible thing about COVID is once you're recovered from it, you have a decent chance of having ongoing symptomatology.
So the idea that if I get COVID, I get COVID, I'll just be over it and be immune to it. Probably not a good theory to live by, huh?
I think it's a pretty cavalier attitude. I mean, granted, most young people who don't have diabetes are not obese and are otherwise healthy. Most young people will do okay. But, you know, if you add on the up to 20% chance that you're still going to have some long-lasting symptom from it. And then also you add on that if you get it, you could spread it to that many other people. I think, you know, being that cavalier is a little dangerous for yourself and for the community.
Is there any evidence at this point that once you have COVID, you cannot get it again or you become terminally immune?
Yes, very good question. It looks like that's not the case. And we can go into vaccines. I know we're running short on time. So definitely get your vaccine when you can, without a doubt. This is very important to get the vaccine. And side effects are minimal. It's very efficacious. But as far as immunity for the vaccine and for the virus itself, we are seeing some cases, a handful of cases of people getting reinfected. Looks like the South African strain looks like it can reinfect you if you've already had it easier than the last or the main COVID strain. So that's really concerning. And also immunity to the vaccines is in question. Looks like there's decreased efficacy of the vaccine to the South African strain. So that's concerning. The UK strain is different in that it seems that the vaccines are working and your immunity will work, but it's more infectious by a factor of, it takes your R value up another 0.5 to 0.6. So the R value is sort of how transmissible it is and how much transmission there is in a community. So an R value of 1 means it's a steady state where your cases aren't really going up or down. If your R it's above 1, then you're getting more cases and still spreading. And if it's going down, your R value is down, then your community is getting better. So if you were at 0.8 and you're slowly decreasing your numbers and this UK strain comes through, now you could be at 1.4 and now you're spreading in your community again and you're back to where you started to some extent. So these mutations, these different strains are concerning because we're still not sure what they're doing, but we've already seen two different strains that have significantly different effect on how it's going to transmit and what it means moving forward.
And we really haven't done a lot of testing on children, correct? So we don't know that children can't be reinfected either.
We don't know. Yeah. But children, I mean, they are less sick when they get it, which is good. Right. There are some cases of severe illnesses and children can die as well from COVID-19, but it's less severe than adults. So that's reassuring. And, you know, all the talk of school opening, you know, it's probably going to be okay if we get the teachers vaccinated. And it seems like the community transmission in schools is pretty low. There's a few decent studies from even the U.S., which look like it was only, what was it? I was just looking this up because it's pretty interesting. We're getting, it's like 28 times less likely or somewhere around 25 times less likely for kids to pass it along than adults, or at least if you compare community transmission to school transmission from the very limited data we have.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your time, Dr. Slaughter. I know you have to get ready to go to work on your shift,
true.
And I appreciate all your information. Anything you want to make sure that you say before getting off?
I think just make sure you get your vaccination as soon as you can. They are safe and efficacious. There's minimal side effects. And it's, if we can get enough people that have had COVID and or get the vaccine, right now we're about a third of people in the United States have had either COVID or the vaccine. And so once we get up to closer to 50 or 60%, we'll be closer to herd immunity. So let's get those vaccines rolling.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Slaughter. And I'm going to turn it back over to you, Rachel.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is listener-supported public radio KCBX, serving South Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. We're always streaming live at kcbx.org. You're listening to Central Coast Voices with host Chris Kington Barker. You're invited to be a part of today's discussion. If you want to bring your comments or questions to today's guests, you can call them in at 805-549-8855 or email them to voices@kcbx.org. It's 1:30. Coming up at 2 o'clock is Latino USA. We'll continue right now with Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Rachel, and welcome back to Central Coast Voices and the second half of today's update about SLO County response to COVID-19 and vaccines. My guests for the second half hour are Ann McDowell, SLO County Public Health Epidemiologist, and Michelle Shoresman, SLO County Health Agency Division Manager and Public Health Public Information Officer for the COVID-19 response with SLO County Public Health. And welcome to both of you for joining me. You have lots of important information to provide on the tale of Dr. Slaughter, and I'm gonna start with just kind of where are we right now with the county's vaccine distribution efforts.
Well, thank you for having us today, Chris. I'll just lead in a little bit and then let Ann give you a little bit of information. But we have been vaccinating people fast and furious, as fast as we can. We now have 3 vaccine distribution sites open, one in Paso Robles, one in San Luis Obispo, and one in Arroyo Grande at the high school. And we are vaccinating healthcare workers, those who are in the phase 1A, what is being known as phase 1A, and those that are 75 years of age and older, that is the very beginnings of the phase 1B that we've been hearing our government officials talking about.
And what is the phase 1B?
Phase 1B is a very large group of individuals. It goes from adults 65 and over, plus it also goes into a number of sectors of different types of people that work in different areas of our economy, basically. Food and ag, educators, those that have been known throughout this pandemic, several of the sectors that have been known throughout this pandemic as essential workers. It's a big group, though, and with the amount of vaccine that we've had so far, we are just barely able to scratch the surface. And so we have, through the recommendations of our vaccine task force, which I could talk about a little bit later, right now we are just vaccinating those 75 and older because they are at greatest risk for deadly outcomes, literally, from COVID-19. And Ann can talk more about that as well.
Okay. And Rachel, did you have a question from a caller?
Yes, Chris. One woman just called in and she says she's a 59-year-old essential worker with a health condition. And she's wondering when a reasonable time would be for her to get vaccinated. What's the expectation?
So we've been getting questions like this from all sorts of individuals with very similar stories. Everybody, you know, we've been saying for quite a while that one of the reasons that COVID is so serious is because it impacts people with underlying health conditions. And approximately 50% of our population has one of those health conditions that makes them more at risk for adverse outcomes from COVID-19. So, and right now we're dealing with a low vaccine supply. We've gotten a little bit more than 22,000 doses in our county, and those are being distributed, as I said, as quickly as I can. Right now, public health is probably one of the bigger vaccinating entities, although our hospitals are also vaccinating their staff as well. And there's a large effort going on to vaccinate those in long-term care facilities as well, that's being coordinated through federal efforts. So it's unfortunate that we off the start did not get, you know, large quantities of vaccines so that we could start immunizing people of all age groups more quickly. But while the vaccine supply is low, we're only able to open it up to one group at a time. But I can assure you that it is our intention to vaccinate everybody that wants a vaccine eventually, and we will get there. It's hard for us to plan too far in advance because we only know what our vaccine allocations are going to be about a week in advance. And right now we're sitting at about administering about 90% of the first doses that have been sent to us. So we're getting it out there. We just don't have very much when you think about 22,000 doses spread over a population of 75 and up. Our population in this county that's 75 and up is estimated to be about 26,000 people. So we haven't even gotten enough doses to vaccinate that small percentage of our population yet. So stay tuned. We will get there, but we probably won't get to, we won't know when we can get to the next opening of age groups or priority groups.
How much notice did you get prior to receiving the vaccine that you were going to receive vaccine and how much you would be provided?
Well, like I said, we receive our allocation about a week before we get it. So okay. We know approximately on Tuesday before the following week what we will receive for the next week.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we have been opening our appointments based on that information. We've been opening our appointments on Thursday morning. So we did open up appointments for next week this morning. And a large majority of those appointments are already taken. There are still some left. But our first week, all the appointments were taken within about 2 hours. So
And the vaccine that we get for this county is the Moderna vaccine, or we get both?
We've received both.
Okay.
Pfizer and the Moderna.
Okay. And when the vaccine is received, it has to be used within what time frame?
Well, that's complicated. once it's been loaded into a syringe, it needs to be used within about 6 hours. Okay. So it can be stored longer than that. It's just once it's been ready, it's been made ready to administer, it needs to be used within a pretty short time frame.
And so when you take it out to a site, is it still frozen if it needs to be frozen? And then how long does it take to defrost it?
I only know for the Pfizer that it takes about half an hour.
Okay.
To thaw a vial. Uh-huh. I'm not sure about the Moderna. Anne, do you know that?
Well, Moderna is frozen at a slightly higher temperature. I mean, it's still frozen, so it takes about the same or maybe a little less time.
So my point is there's a coordination of timing on a lot of different aspects of giving the injections, correct?
Yes.
And the coordination of the immunizations of how many you're going to be giving, how much you're going to be, because once you defrost it, once it's unfrozen, it needs to be given.
Correct. Yeah. There is a great deal of logistics around providing these immunizations to people.
Yeah, it's not the same as the other injections the other immunizations we get in the CVS pharmacy, say.
Yeah, so that's one reason why we have not had wide distribution around the usual ways that those of us go to get our flu vaccine or our childhood immunizations. Most providers do not have the extra cold freezing capacity at their disposal. Some have been able to ramp that up, and obviously some organizations do have that already, but that is definitely one of the requirements in order to become a vaccine provider for this particular vaccine. So it has been a limiting factor, especially in more rural areas of the state and country.
Luckily,
ahead for this.
Yeah.
Purchased some of those those valuable freezers early on before the vaccine was provided to us. So public health was ready to go.
Okay, great. And can you describe about how the vaccine is going to be getting out now? Are there going to be more sites that are going to be coming online as there's more vaccine that comes in? Or you anticipate that these three sites are really going to be the primary ones?
Right now, we're working on trying to staff up and get these three sites that we have ready to vaccinate approximately 3,000 people a day. Our goal, we're not currently doing that many doses a day, but we are staffing up and figuring out the logistics so that those three sites can eventually be able to give out 1,000 doses per site per day. And then we are also hopeful that more of our local healthcare providers and pharmacies, you know, those avenues that we're all used to going and receiving healthcare from, will be able to get up to speed and get the logistics in order and the application process in order to be able to provide vaccine. But I think we're also trying to think creatively about what other opportunities there might be in the future, especially to reach those who have been adversely impacted by this virus and may not have good access to healthcare,
right,
or access to information about good healthcare. So I think there will be all sorts of different vaccination efforts going on in the future. I just don't even know what those look like at this point.
Michelle, if other entities were to have the resources or purchase the resources to be able to do this, could they apply to be a site in addition to what the county is receiving? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they can.
Okay.
There is an application process that has been made available to healthcare providers.
Okay.
We've done provider advisories on how to go about doing that. And we also have information on our recoverslow.org/vaccines website, where providers can go to learn about that process and start the application process themselves.
Now, can you talk just for a moment about, you said that there are still some slots open, and there is a website that people can go to that they can register if they're 75 or older, right? And are healthcare workers are still being immunized as well?
Correct.
And they can register and they can go to recoverslow.org/vaccines, right?
It's actually a forward slash.
Forward, okay.
And I actually found out just before I was getting on this call that we have now, just for the appointments page specifically, so you can go straight to that page, we've created an easier URL for that, and it's recoverslow.org/vaccine appointments.
Vaccine appointments. Okay. And a couple of things that people need to know about that. They need to be able to demonstrate, if they're going for the 75 and older, they have to have something that shows that they're definitely 75 or older, right?
Correct.
They can't just show up looking old.
Correct. You'll need to have something that verifies ability to meet the requirement for that particular priority group. So if you're a healthcare provider, you'll have to have a pay stub or an ID from where you work. And if you're 75 or older, you'll need to have an ID that demonstrates what your age is and that your birth date is such that it makes you 75 or older. And you'll also need to provide some sort of local identification that shows that you're a resident of this county.
Okay.
We want to do what we can to make sure that people that we're giving the San Luis Obispo County vaccine to are actually San Luis Obispo County residents.
Have we had any problems that they've had, say, in Florida with people migrating for vaccines? Have we had any issues with that?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if we've had that particular instance specifically, but we have had people who've had difficulty making appointments online, or just heard that they were now eligible for the vaccine. And so they show up at the vaccine site on a walk-in basis attempting to get a vaccine, and unfortunately, we have to turn those people away if they haven't made an appointment. We just don't have the ability right now to handle a large number of walk-ins because of the low vaccine supply.
There have been some other private parties that have done some vaccines. There are a couple of CVS pharmacies that have taken appointments also, and I think, is it French Hospital that has done some vaccines by appointment?
Correct. We're trying to keep our website updated with any of those providers that have gotten approval to give vaccine themselves. To my knowledge right now, I know that there are several Vons pharmacies, and then there is also a link to Dignity Health's vaccine appointment website on our website.
Okay, and Rachel has another question from a caller.
Yeah, a caller would like to know how you plan on coordinating the second dose of the vaccine.
There's a lot of logistics that go into that as well. Our team has created a system by which once you've gotten your first vaccine, you notify us what means of communication you would like us to communicate with you by in order to get your second vaccine dose. And we are emailing people, texting people, whatever method they've chosen, calling people to set up those second dose vaccine appointments. Because we are focusing first and foremost on first doses, and we have not been shipped as many second doses, we are looking at spreading out the amount of time that is done between first and second doses, basically. So there are recommendations by each manufacturer of each vaccine that state the amount of time that you should wait between first and second doses. And because we have a lower supply of second doses available, we are going by the CDC's recommendation of a maximum of 6 weeks between first and second doses. So that will play into when you get your reminder for your second dose.
So rather than showing up at, say, 4 weeks for Moderna, it would be 6 weeks.
Well, it's really going to depend on, but what I'm saying
is availability.
For example, the Pfizer vaccine, the initial recommendation on the vaccine was that you can get your second dose 21 days or more after the first dose. And so many of the healthcare workers early on were getting their second doses right at 3 weeks after the first dose had been administered. But the CDC has said there is no loss in efficacy if you wait as much as 6 weeks to get that second dose. So people shouldn't panic if they've gotten their first dose, and they don't need to worry about getting it right on, you know, the first day that you're allowed to. That's sort of a minimum amount of time required, but it's not the maximum. And the CDC has also said that people should not worry, even if they're not able to get their second dose within 6 weeks of the first dose, that it doesn't mean they'll have to restart the series over again, that the efficacy of the doses is enough that they can just get that second booster whenever they have the opportunity to do it, and they will still see good efficacy from it.
And what you're trying to do is immunize more people without compromising any of the people that are already immunized with one dose.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX. Central Coast, your listener-supported radio station. You're listening to Michelle Shoresman, SLO County Health Agency Division Manager and Public Information Officer for COVID-19 Response with San Luis County Public Health. And also coming up to is Ann McDowell, SLO County Public Health Epidemiologist. If you have questions or comments about today's discussion, you can call them in to us at KCBX at 805-549-8855 or email them at voices@kcbx.org. And Ann, I was going to check in with you about some of the things that are happening with the virus and some of the different variants that are circulating around. Have we seen any variants here in San Luis County?
Hi, it's good to be here. No, we have not seen any variants here in
That's
San Luis Obispo
news.
County. And we have been sending a sample of our virus up for genomic sequencing to San Francisco all along during this epidemic. So we've been able to tell that we haven't seen any variants up until this point. We'll continue to send our samples off for sequencing, and we'll see where we go.
So every time someone is tested positive, it goes for sequencing?
Not every time. We select
randomly?
A subsample.
Yeah,
random subsamples to be able to see where we're going.
Oh, that's great. And then can you talk a little bit about the tier metrics that we've been working on and what we need to do in order? We just came down from being on stay at home. And kind of what that means in terms of what we need to do now, does that mean that we can go back to normal life? Or?
Well, I don't think normal has been normal for a while yet, but right now there's a four-tier system in place to allow you to do certain activities in each tier, and we are unfortunately still in purple tier, which is the highest tier. It means that COVID is pretty widespread in our area. This is calculated on a county-by-county basis. So it's up to us in San Luis Obispo County to get into that next red tier. And movement between tiers is based on three things. One, it's what your test positivity is. And how many, what percentage of all the tests that are given are positive. And we're doing pretty good right there. Last week we were at 5.5%, and we need to be below 8% in order to move to the next tier. So in that particular, in one out of three, we're doing okay. Another one is the health equity metric, and that's where we look at zip codes and census tracts in our county. And we take 25% of those that are in the worst economic conditions and compare them to the other 75%. To make sure that A, we're testing equitably across all those regions, and B, that the rate of positivity isn't higher, and we're also meeting the metric to move up in that particular one. In other words, we're doing a great job of making sure everybody in the county has an availability to test, and the positivity rates aren't significantly higher in that group. It's unfortunately the last one where we're having some difficulty, and that's the case rate. That is how many people are testing positive, not how many out of how many tested, but overall the population. So the state currently says our population is about 278,000 people, and that we need to have fewer than 7 people per 100,000 per day test positive. So that's actually about 19.5 cases per day on a 7-day average. Last week, we were pretty high. We were at 47.7. The good news is we get an adjustment rate based on the number of case tests we're administering throughout the county, and we have the highest rate of testing in the state as of last week, which is pretty impressive when you think about it. We are testing more people in our county than anybody else in the state. So our case rate gets adjusted based on the fact that we're testing a lot of people. And so, in fact, it knocked it down to 23.8, which is really good. What we need to be below, though, is 19.5. So the big news is we need to have fewer infections. And so while we're starting to get vaccinated and hopefully that'll prevent infection, we're still going to be looking for non-pharmaceutical interventions to help us slow that. And that means still wearing our masks, still doing social distancing, trying not to have large congregations, sticking to your pod of people, things that'll help slow the spread. The good news is this week we've seen lower testing positivity in our community testing sites. So we think we're going in the right direction, but we'll have to wait until next week to see how well we did.
That's great. Yeah. Do you think that the climb after the holidays has kind of peaked, or
We certainly hope so. And we've seen this after every large holiday since the pandemic began. You know, first 4th of July. I think actually it was first it was Easter. We saw a little bump. And then it was 4th of July.
Memorial Day.
Memorial Day and Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I'm hopeful that that these big peaks are going to even out at this point and stop.
What is it that we need to do in order to get kids back to school? Is that something that's really being looked at carefully and something that your department is working with, the county is working
Absolutely.
With?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have reached out, and Dr. Bornstein is working very closely with Dr. Brescia, with the County Office of Education, to make sure that all the districts in the county can submit their applications to reopen so that when we get into the red tier, which is in the next tier, they're eligible to open if they wish to. Mm-hmm. And we're making sure that their plans are taking into account safety for the children, safety for the for the teachers, safety for everyone involved. But once again, we have to move into that red tier for schools to be able to open per the current state guidelines. And so we really need to drive the number of people who are being infected down at this point in order to get into that red tier. But once again, even in the red tier, we need to be there for 2 weeks before schools can reopen.
And teachers are not considered essential workers in terms of immunizing, right?
Teachers are part of that 1B category. So it really depends at this point on vaccine availability as well as recommendations from the vaccine task force that we have implemented locally. We have a group of leaders from all across the county representing different sectors, and we have a couple of representatives on that task force from the education sector. And so that group, when there is discretion amongst the sort of sub-tiers within the phases, that group is meeting regularly and making recommendations to the health department about which groups will be able to go next. We are also hearing some proposals from the state that they may try to standardize at some point in the future. The variability that we're seeing now from county to county based on vaccine availability. We're also hearing that they may attempt to open up some vaccine distribution themselves from the state level. But all of this is still changeable information. We continually seek guidance from those state and federal entities on what this is going to mean for us locally in San Luis Obispo. So I think I can speak for the department and Dr. Bornstein, because I've heard her say it many times that she definitely wants schools to be open and to be able to open safely. But there's still definitely a lot of variables, and vaccine is one. Ann discussed that, you know, there are a lot of tools in the toolbox to help protect us from COVID, and vaccine is only one of them, but it is an important one.
And one, be patient, get it when you are eligible, go to recoverslow.org, vaccine appointments. And I want to thank my guests for today's show, Dr. Clint Slaughter, Ann McDowell, and Michelle Shoresman. Next week, join Fred Monroe. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the Slow Community Foundation. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us today.